This recording of Dr. Peter Gentry is from a one-day conference hosted by Grace Fellowship Church, Don Mills, in October 2014. For more information on the church, please visit gfcdonmills.ca. The material for the conference was taken from Dr. Gentry's work with Stephen Wellum, published in the book titled Kingdom Through Covenant. To learn more about any of the things Dr. Gentry teaches, please pick up a copy of the book and begin your investigation there. We hosted this conference and make the audio available for free because we believe that sound biblical theology is necessary for the health of every Christian and each local church. May God bless you as you explore His Word. Due to technical difficulties, our original recording of the first session was lost. This recording, however, was graciously provided by a conference attendee, but the audio quality has suffered. The recordings for the rest of the sessions will be better. We apologize for any inconvenience.
Well, I am so excited to be here with you today. I'm rather shocked at the number of people that are here. And I take this as a testimony, not to me, but to a real hunger for the Word of God. I've written a book with my friend and colleague Stephen Wellum called Kingdom Through Covenant, and we're arguing that the covenants are the key to the plot structure of the Bible. The term covenant is kind of old-fashioned, and not only is it not a very well-known word today, but it's not a word that is even understood by our culture in the way that the Bible presents it. The word covenant occurs almost 300 times in the Bible, and it's used in a wide variety of ways, a very wide variety of ways. It's also used in the ancient Near East, the countries that were contemporary with ancient Israel, ancient Egypt, Syria, ancient Assyria and Babylonia, what is today Iraq and Iran. The word covenant is used there in ancient documents pretty much in the same way that it's used in the Bible. Out of all of the covenants that are mentioned, or the agreements or covenants that are mentioned in the Bible, there are six covenants that I would argue are the key to the plot structure. And when I say that, we're looking at the Bible not simply as a collection of books, but as a single text. The Bible is an interesting book because it is written by human authors, but at the same time, the claim is made that these authors were inspired by God. So we're looking at the Bible as a single book, as a single text, with a single plot structure. I hope you know what a plot structure is. If you read a book or watch a movie, generally it has a plot structure. And you can go to IMDb, internationalmoviedatabase.com, and get a summary of the plot structure. Some movies do not have a linear plot structure, but they still have a plot structure. All movies, except Napoleon Dynamite, have a plot structure. So when we look at the Bible as a book, as a piece of literature, we should expect that there's a plot structure. And it just so happens that there's more suspense in the Bible than there is in the Hunger Games. So hang with me here today. These main covenants, there are six main agreements between God and humans. There's the covenant that was made at creation itself when God made the world. There's the creation that God made with Noah and his family. There's the covenant that was made with Abraham and his family that was later called Israel. There's a covenant that was made with the whole nation of Israel when they came out of Egypt and were coming through the desert and stopped at Sinai. This covenant was reaffirmed in the book of Deuteronomy on the plains of Moab just before they entered into the country of Canaan, which has been called Palestine and Israel. Then, later on, God made a covenant with the king, with David. And finally, there is a new covenant. And so we are going to look at those six covenants. What we may well ask in literary terms is the plot structure of the Old Testament, or even the entire Bible, as a single text. The basic idea of our book, and by the way, we are coming out with a 250-page abridgment, which some of you may be happy to hear about. The basic idea of this book is that the covenants constitute the framework of the larger story. They are the backbone of the plot structure. The biblical story begins with the fact that there is only one God. He has created everything, and especially made humankind to rule under him. In this context, God is the center of the universe, and we humans find our purpose in having a right relationship to him and to one another. The first man and woman, however, rejected this way. Now, what happens when God is no longer at the center of the universe? Who steps in to take his place? Why, we do. I want to be at the center of the universe. Will this work? No, because you want to be there too. So chaos and evil have reigned since the rebellion of Adam and Eve, because we no longer had a right relationship with God and did not treat each other in genuinely human ways. God judged the entire human race and made a new start with Noah. This too ended up in chaos and evil, as is clear from the story of the Tower of Babel. Finally, he made a new start with Abraham. He would restore a creation and humanity ruined by pride and rebellion by using Abraham and his family as a pilot project. The people of Israel would be an example, a light to the world of what it meant to be properly related to God and to treat each other according to the dignity of our humanity. We may call this the Mosaic Covenant, set forth in Exodus and reaffirmed in Deuteronomy. But the people of Israel did not keep the Mosaic Covenant. They were to be blessed for obedience, cursed for disobedience. This is why the biblical story ends up by talking about a new covenant. This time it would be possible to keep this covenant. If you see what I've done, I've just summarized the entire Bible in 300 words using the covenants as a way to do that. That may not mean anything to you, but I did a PhD at the University of Toronto, and my dissertation was 600 pages. After I finished that, they said, now you have to write an abstract. We want you to summarize in 300 words what you have now said in 600 pages, and we will not accept 301 words. So you have to be able to summarize, and an abstract is a summary. You can see that the covenants are a very good way of summarizing the entire Bible story and putting the whole plot structure together. I want to briefly compare covenants and contracts. Our culture really does not understand what a covenant is. Most of the covenant relationships in our society have become business contracts instead of relationships of faithfulness, of loyalty, of commitment, of obedience, of trust, and of love. An example is, for example, Genesis 47, verses 29 to 30, when Jacob is about to die, when the time drew near for Israel, also called Jacob, to die, he called for his son Joseph, and he said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh and promise that you will show me kindness and faithfulness." The Hebrew words are chesed and emeth. "Do not bury me in Egypt, but when I rest with my fathers, carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they are buried. I will do as you say," he said. So we see here an example of a covenant relationship. In the Old Testament, family relationships are covenant relationships. We see, secondly, the obligation of the stronger party to help the weaker party. In this case, the dying father is the weaker party and the strong son is the stronger party. And we see, thirdly, that the fulfillment of this obligation demonstrates loyal love. In Hebrew, they use pairs of words to communicate a single idea. We do the same thing in English, for example. We say, "by and large." That's an expression, "by and large." Well, you can talk about "by" and you can talk about "large," but it doesn't tell you anything about the expression "by and large." And that's chesed and emeth. You can talk about chesed and you can talk about emeth, but it doesn't tell you anything about what happens when you put the two together. And chesed and emeth means faithful, loyal love and keeping your obligations in a permanent and committed relationship. We're going to see the book of Psalms is one of the biggest books in the Bible, 150 chapters. And the shortest psalm is Psalm 117. "Praise the Lord, all you nations, extol him, all you peoples, for great is his love, his chesed, towards us, and the faithfulness or emeth of the Lord endures forever." This is the PhD dissertation abstract from the whole book of Psalms. It's all boiled down into two verses. It's a call to all the nations to celebrate the God of the Bible. Why? Because he is always showing faithful, loyal love in all of his covenant relationships. And that's the reason you should buy into him today. The covenant with Noah is the one that we're going to begin talking about, because this is the first time we actually see the word covenant in the Bible. Genesis 6, verse 18. God says to Noah, "But I will establish my covenant with you." So we're going to start there. First, we need to consider the context in which God makes this statement to Noah and the meaning of the language used in this text. In the previous verse, God informs Noah that he is going to destroy all life upon the earth, all human and animal life in the entire world. And it might be useful for you to read the Bible, because the Bible is very different from the movies. The means of destruction will be a cataclysmic event, floodwaters covering the entire earth. God instructs Noah, however, to construct a big box. They didn't know what a boat was. They didn't know what a ship was. The word ark is simply an old-fashioned word for box. I'm sure Noah really didn't know what he was doing, but he did follow the instructions, and it did work. This box will be the means of rescue and deliverance for the destruction of the flood. The earlier part of chapter 6 explains why God had apparently given up upon the human race and decided upon such a severe judgment. In verse 5, we are told, the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil all the time. By the way, in the Hebrew Bible, the heart is not an organ that pumps blood. The heart is the center of your being, where you feel, where you think, and where you make decisions. In our society, when we think of heart, we think of Valentine's Day. And we talk about people who have a problem bridging the gap between their head and their hearts. This is impossible for a Hebrew. Over 400 uses of the word, there are 800 uses of the word heart in the Old Testament, and over 400 of them have to do with thinking. The other 400 have to do with feeling and making decisions. So there's no gap between the head and the heart in the Old Testament. In verses 11 to 13, we read, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on the earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them." Verse 5 describes the human situation as bad, evil, or wicked, and traces this condition to the human heart, the center of our being, where we feel, reason, and make decisions. In verses 11 to 13, two words stand out in particular, corrupt and violence. The first word occurs three times, the second word occurs twice, so that the cumulative effect is pronounced. It is difficult for the reader to miss the message. The term corrupt shows that a beautiful and good situation is now ruined, spoiled, and twisted. Frequently, not many hours after opening the presents on Christmas Day, children manage to ruin and spoil intricate and beautiful toys so that they are damaged in appearance and function. The term violence, the Hebrew word chamas, is a word that refers specifically to social violence and conditions in human society where social justice is lacking. You don't have to look far to understand what I'm talking about. The evil of the human heart resulted in corruption and social violence brings a response from God, according to verses 6 and 7. The Lord was grieved, that is, he was pained to his heart that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. The flood, then, is a response, a judgment, in response to the evil of the human heart and the resultant corruption and violence. Before we look further at God's covenant with Noah, I want to talk briefly about covenants in the Bible. And a nice example is Genesis 21, verses 22 to 34. This is an interesting example of a covenant that was made between Abraham and the king of Gerar, a city in the south of Israel or Palestine, just west of Beersheba. And this king makes a covenant or a treaty. A treaty. The word covenant is used for all kinds of agreements, whether they're marriage agreements, whether they're clan alliances, whether they're international treaties. It's the same word. So these two guys make a treaty. Four features characterize this treaty. Number one, the covenant does not begin the relationship. It can formalize in binding and legal terms an agreement between parties who have already developed, who have already developed the relationship. Notice that in verse 23, the king, whose name is Abimelech, talks chesed that he has shown in the past. So they already had dealings in the past. Verse 2, number 2, there is a conventional expression in Hebrew for making a treaty, and it's to cut a covenant. Why this is so, we'll see later. Number 3, a covenant gives binding and legal status to a relationship by means of a formal and solemn ceremony. So, every covenant is celebrated by a solemn ceremony, and it's a public ceremony. This is why it's wrong to be broke, because there's no public ceremony, and you don't have a covenant in the biblical sense of the word. I'm not a practical man, but there is a practical application. Number 4, covenant making involves a commitment or oath or promise, and frequently signs or witnesses. Here the parties of the treaty solemnly swear to the agreement. While an oath is an important part of the covenant, it is not the covenant itself. In the ancient Near East, they had a very strange ceremony. They would take animals, they would cut them in half. The halves would be laid facing each other. Then the parties of the treaty would walk in the blood between the two halves of the dead animals. This action is symbolic. What is being expressed is this. If each party is saying, if I fail to keep my obligation or my promise, may I be cut in two like this dead animal. The oath or promise then involves bringing a curse upon oneself for violating the treaty. Might not be a bad idea to bring this back to our marriage ceremony. We might have less divorce. Many other covenants and treaties are recorded in the Bible. As examples, one may mention the covenant between Joshua and the Gibeonites, Joshua 9 between the men of Jabesh-Gilead and Naphtali the Ammonite, two covenants between David and Jonathan, one between David and Abner, David and Israel, Ahab of Israel and Ben-Hadad of Syria, and also between Jehoiada the high priest and King Joash. So while there are a variety of covenants, and the nature and status of the parties differ, and the language differs, in each case, a covenant concluded involves a commitment or promise, usually solemnized by oath, in which an agreement and level of relationship between the parties is specified. I want to talk about initiating a covenant versus upholding a covenant. The first occurrences of the word covenant in the Old Testament is significant. This word appears 8 times in the flood story, which is Genesis chapter 6 to chapter 9. In 4 places, God speaks of confirming or establishing or upholding a covenant. The Hebrew expression is hakeem berith. The other 4 places talk about the sign of the covenant and remembering the covenant. Thus, when we think about the covenant that God made with Noah and his family and his descendants, we can see right away that the normal expression for making a covenant is not found in this story. A shock to the reader. Why does this story talk about confirming or upholding a covenant instead of making a covenant? The difference in these expressions can be illustrated in the case of the agreement between God and Abraham that we see in Genesis 15 and 17. In Genesis 15, God makes a covenant with Abraham, and we have the expression kerat berith, to cut a covenant. In chapter 17, what God does is he confirms or upholds that covenant. And so three times in chapter 17, we have the expression hekin berith, the same one that we have in Genesis 6 through 9, because God is now coming to fulfill his promise. He says, after 825 years, next year you're going to have a baby. So I'm going to keep my promise. And so that's why we have that expression there, because God isn't making a covenant in chapter 17. The covenant was already made in chapter 15. But he's now coming to fulfill his obligation to uphold his promise, to keep his promise that was made in the covenant at an earlier time. So in Genesis 6 through 9, when we see that God is upholding his covenant with Noah, this means that there was a covenant made earlier that is being upheld in God's relationship with Noah. And that can only refer to a covenant that was made at the time of creation. I will talk a little bit more about this later. But a nice example is Jeremiah 34. Jeremiah 34, verses 8, 13, and 15. What happens in Jeremiah 34 is the people of God are given instructions in the covenant. And one of those instructions is that if a person is so poor, if an Israelite is so poor that they sell themselves as a slave, that they are to be set free after in the seventh year. And the big businessmen in Israel were not following this instruction in the covenant. They were not setting free their Israelite slaves. And so they made an agreement, they made a covenant to set the Israelite slaves free. And that expression is cut a covenant. They made a covenant. And they set the slaves free. But then, later on, they went back on their agreement. I don't know what, you know the word renege? They reneged on their agreement. They went back on their agreement. And they re-enslaved the people that they had made free. And so in verse 15 it says, they did not uphold the covenant. And that's the expression, hekin berith. So that's a clear example of the difference between making a covenant and upholding it. So when God says that he is upholding his covenant with Noah, he is saying that his commitment, initiated previously at creation, to care for and preserve, to provide for and rule over all that he has made, including the blessings and commands that he gave to Adam and Eve and their family, are now to be with Noah and his descendants. And this can be supported by noticing literary parallels between Noah and Adam. I'm going to skip over these things, but they're in the book, and I show that there are literary parallels between the Noah story and the Adam story that will cause the reader to see that the author wants you to compare these two people. The author wants you to see Noah as a new Adam, making a new start, and that the flood story is like a new creation. I want to talk now about the parties of the covenant, the promise of the covenant, and the sign of the covenant. This is in Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9, verses 8 to 17, tell us about the parties of the covenant, the promise of the covenant, and the sign of the covenant. Actually, I skipped over one part, the terms of the covenant. say that again. There are verses 1 to 7 give us the terms of the covenant, and then verses 8 to 17 give us the parties, the promise, and the sign. So let's look at verses 1 to 7. In Genesis 9, verses 1 to 7, God blesses Noah and commissions him as a new Adam, giving him Adam's mandate, modified somewhat to suit the circumstances of a fallen world. Genesis 9, verses 8 to 17, describes the covenant, its parties, and its sign. It's all right with you folks, I'm hot. I'm fired up about my topic. I'll take my coat off. I hope that won't offend you. It might offend my colleagues in the South, but Canadians are laid back. So. First, Noah is told to be fruitful and increase in number and to fill the earth. You know the Bible, this is exactly what God told Adam in Genesis 1. So Noah is inheriting Adam's mission and commission. Notice that verse 7 repeats this. Verse 7 repeats this. But as for you, be fruitful and increase, swarm in the earth and increase in it. This repetition in verse 1 and verse 7 shows that the blessing is like the bookends and the commands are in the middle. You see how the literary structure gives you a picture of how God's heart works. He's giving instructions, but those instructions are surrounded by his blessings. Number 2, we see that the fear of you and the dread of you will be upon the wild animals of the earth and the birds of the sky and upon all the creatures that crawl upon the ground and upon the fish of the sea. In Genesis 1, humans were commanded to rule over the earth and subdue it. God now assists humans in this task in a fallen world by placing the fear of them upon the animals, the birds, the fish, and all creatures that move. Fear of humans may also assist humans in catching creatures for consumption and nourishment, and so relate to the next instruction or stipulation. So what we see here is the Bible says that every animal naturally fears a human being. A few years ago, we were in Australia, and we took a trip to Tasmania. Talk about the end of the world. And the strange creatures that existed. And my son had a very strong interest in snakes. We were coming down the road. On the right-hand side was a Tasmanian zoo that featured the devil and the wombat, which looks very huggable, but I assure you it's not. And on the left-hand side was a tiger snake farm. Okay. Now in Australia, they don't give names to snakes. They measure all the snakes in minutes. That means how many minutes you have left to live after you're bitten. This is a 10-minute snake, and this is a 2-minute snake, and this is a 1-minute snake. So the tiger snake is less than 1 minute. Okay, this is a really bad snake. And what I did is I paid for my son to go to the left-hand side of the road, and the rest of the family went to the right-hand side. My son said that when the keeper got inside the ring with the baby snakes, they ran away. That's one of the most dangerous animals in the world. There's the fear of humans. Once they lose their fear of humanity, it's the end. I'm serious. I've done a lot of hiking in the Rocky Mountains. I'm a real Canadian. I grew up in school in Edmonton, Alberta, and I lived in Toronto for 25 years. So I was hiking out in Whistler campground, and that year the snow was very late in melting, and so the bears didn't go up into the hinterlands right away. People came to camp, people bring garbage, and the garbage was good for the bears. So they didn't leave. And there was one bear that became a nuisance bear. And so they came and shot him with the poison, with the dart, you know, that tranquilizes them, and drove the bear 100 miles away. You know what happened? The bear beat the truck back to the camp. So basically, when you take away their fear of humanity, it's the same as killing them. Bible has a lot of useful instructions, and people don't believe in creation, they don't read the Bible, and so they do very stupid things. I saw a person feeding potato chips to a bear over here. Genesis 1 makes a very clear distinction between animals that can be tamed and animals that cannot be tamed. And this, since the people of Toronto don't believe in God, they don't believe in creation, they do stupid things like have pets, like weasels and skunks, which I have seen in Allen Gardens. And a long time ago, you remember the story of the boa constrictor that came to us. Someone had an apartment in the James Finch corridor, and it went down the plumbing and came up in somebody else's apartment. So if you don't read the Bible, it could be the end of your life. You need to pay attention basic instructions that will help you understand the world in which we live. Third, the animals are given to the human race for food, just as the plants were given at creation for food. There are two important restrictions. First, humans are not to eat flesh or meat with its blood. And later, instructions given in the Law of Moses clarify this, because the life is in the blood. So the reason why we're not allowed to eat the blood is that even though we're allowed to kill animals for nourishment, we must recognize that humans are not the Lord of life. God is the Lord of life. That's why we do that. And as a general rule, in Canada and the United States, there is no blood in anything that, any meat that is sold. Second, human life is set apart. This prevents not only cannibalism, but also homicide. Even animals that killed humans are held responsible. Fourth, human life is special and of priceless value and worth. God specifies two things concerning homicide. First, the human race is one family. We are all related. When a human life is wantonly taken, we are our brother's keeper. This is not very clear in the English translations, but in verse 5, I translate from the Hebrew, "And also your blood, the blood of your lives, I will demand an accounting from the hand of every wild animal, or every animal I will demand it, and from the hand of the man," that is, "from the hand of the man, his brother, I will demand an accounting for the life of the man," for the life of the human. Did you know this is the first time since the story of Cain and Abel that the word brother occurs in the text? In the story of Cain and Abel, it's Cain committed a crime against the family, against his brother. And the author emphasizes that 8 times. He says, your brother, Abel, your brother. So the human family is all, the human race is one family. And we are our brother's keeper. And the way we do this in our society is to allow the government to administer this. into our wrong hands. It's not a Old Kentucky one for you. I have to teach this when I'm down there. Some people say, you can see here that if the Bible prescribes the death penalty. So some people say, well, when the government administers the death penalty, they're committing murder. That's not true. They are simply taking the responsibility of being our brother's keeper. And then in this verse it says, whoever sheds the blood of a man, by man his blood will be shed, or at the cost of a man his blood will be shed. You can read in the book, and that's the interpretation that I take is that his blood will be shed in exchange for the murdered person. The principle of justice in the Torah, in the first five books of the Bible, and throughout the Bible, is what is called retributive justice. This means that the penalty must be as much as, but certainly not a hair more than the damage that has been done. And that's why it's expressed in the terms an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, and eventually a life for a life. The penalty must be as much as, but not more than, the damages that are done. This is the difference between the Bible and Sharia law, because in the Bible we have real retributive justice, but you don't in Sharia law, because the penalties are not fair.
Flood has not solved the problem.
The eight people have walked out of the ark. The inclination of their heart was to not to do the right, but to do the wrong thing. And we see that happening right away at the end of chapter 9 with the strange story of Noah's drunkenness. What this means is that God would be completely justified to destroy every generation. And the only reason he doesn't is because of his grace. You are alive today because God is withholding what is due you justly. What this also shows us is when something goes wrong, we often say, why not give them a brand new start? That's exactly what God does. He gives the whole world a brand new start. And this does not solve the problem. You see that? Erasing everything and giving people a brand new start does not solve the problem that is inside us. We want to live our lives independently of God and do our own thing. The sign of the covenant. The sign of the covenant. The sign of the covenant, according to this text, is a rainbow. But this may interest you. There is no word in Hebrew for rainbow. This bow is an archer's bow. They don't play bows and arrows. Do you know how to play bows and arrows? God has turned his weapon of war into a many-splendored arch of beauty. When you see the rainbow, it means God is telling you, I have laid my weapons down. And if you see a rainbow, it's always pointing up at God. It's never pointing down at us. The fact that the rainbow is still with us today shows us that God is, that this covenant is valid today, and God is keeping his side of the agreement, whether or not we are keeping our side of the agreement. The covenant with Noah upholds the divine image, and this is what we'll be discussing next. The covenant with Noah is instructive because it shows that being given a fresh start and a clean slate is not a sufficient remedy for the human problem. The unmerited favor and kindness of God in preserving his world in the covenant with Noah gives a firm stage for history where God can work out his plan for rescuing his fallen world. And it also points ahead to the coming deliverance in Jesus Christ. There we are, that's our first break.